Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio on the 11th of February 2017. My name's Hereward Fenton. Great to have you aboard. Today I'm going to be talking about the Iran question, which has been big in the news in the last week, obviously, with the statements coming out from the President of the United States and the Defense Secretary alleging that Iran is the number one sponsor of state terrorism and that Iran has been put on notice. And of course this has really changed the tone of the current administration and changed the perception of a lot of people who are awake and who are not tied in to a strict ideological position or a kind of team-oriented position in terms of what they support. A lot of alternative bloggers have realized that this is perhaps very, very significant. We can't say for sure. It's a little too early to know, but it looks like, and this is coupled with the currently suspended executive order on immigration, it looks like a strategy is being put in place that leads to war with Iran. And there are quite a number of parts to this. And I've got an interesting article here by Tony Cartolucci, who's an excellent writer and has done a lot of really good research. And he's often been published on InfoWars. But I think in this case, InfoWars is not going to pick him up because InfoWars has a very strict adherence to Trumpism. And what we're seeing now and what some people like Cartolucci are pointing out is that what we're actually seeing, what looks like the old pattern of US empire and hegemony, just aimed in a different direction. But actually, even that isn't completely new. It's really, you look back and you see, no, this is actually part of a plan that was forged 15 years ago. And so that's kind of what I want to go into a little bit today. And there's been quite a few excellent articles and podcasts already done on this topic. I want to also connect this to the pattern of quite virulent anti-Islamic rhetoric to see that basically what's going on here is that there's a kind of a softening up of public opinion based on the horrific nature of what we've seen with extremist Islam to make it more acceptable that the US would engage in further military actions against Islamic nations. Now, this, of course, is not the way it's directly being framed. It's not the way it's being pitched to you by the US administration. But this is very much the background chatter, the background rhetoric coming from sources like Breitbart and its editor, Milo Yiannopoulos. And I just want to play a little clip of one of his recent speeches to illustrate that. So we have Iran, of course, being a fundamentalist Islamic state, a theocratic Islamic state, and we have the ongoing crisis with Islamic extremism in the Middle East. And let's face it, yes, we do have a problem with the encroachment of authoritarian elements of Islamism into the West, and I'll be the first to agree with that, and I'm totally against it. Right. But those who are trying to engineer a path to war are pulling all these strings together. And this is what you've got to have your eyes open and understand and be aware of. Because when it happens, it'll happen with a huge convergence of factors. And many people will be sucked into being behind it because of the preparation in their minds to accept that when it comes to an Islamic state, we're dealing with pure evil. Now, I've done a number of shows where I've attempted to explain why it is that Islam has increasingly, over the last century, become associated with intolerance, authoritarianism, and violence. And I want to go through some of that with you again today. And I want to illustrate the fact that that the regressive tendency within Islamic societies has actually been a result of a response to Western imperialism, which has been encroaching on the Middle East since the late 19th century. The British occupied Egypt in 1882 during the Anglo-Egyptian War. And from that point onwards, there was increasing a tendency among the British, among the foreign policy of the West, to try to control and shape nation building in the Middle East. And of course, this really took off after World War One, and then again had a huge boost after World War Two, and the wars, indeed, appear to have been the events that precipitate increased control and increased interference in the Middle East. And of course, we've seen that continuing right on up through the first Gulf War in 1991, and then the second Gulf War in 2003, and then, of course, the destabilization wars against Libya and Syria right up to the present. And there are many other events in between those, but just to cite, there are a few very clear milestones in this pattern. And Iran, of course, was the subject of deliberate destabilization when they had a nationalist government that, again, was trying to shake off the shackles of British interference. And we saw the destabilization of that regime in the 1950s and a replacement with a Western-friendly regime, which was very, very oppressive, and which ended up itself being overthrown in the Islamic Revolution in 1979. But the point I want to make here is that with each successive phase of Western empire building and attempts to control through violence the societies in this part of the world, there has been a reaction of increasing radical nature from the people. And it sprang, it initially sprang from their cultural roots, from Islam. And the first sign of this was actually the Muslim Brotherhood, which was formed in Egypt and which was largely a reaction to the British rule over Egypt. And the British occupied Egypt from 1882 right through to 1956. And so the Muslim Brotherhood, which by many is seen as being kind of the kernel of Islamic fundamentalism and jihadism, had its origins in an anti-colonial movement, in a rejection of British rule. And in doing so, the people who followed that group and the people who came from that part of the world, you know, they tried to reassert their own cultural values. And we saw very similar things happen in India. And we saw a lot of violence associated with that in India too, including among the Hindu population. And we have to remember that it was a Hindu who assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. It was not a Muslim. And there was a lot of violence against Muslims from the Hindu majority in India, which partly led to the foundation of Pakistan. But that's a slight sidetrack. But the point I'm trying to make, but that again is connected to the imperial pattern, where the British had been completely suppressing that part of the world for a very, very long period of time, for several hundred years. And then, of course, you had this outburst of attempts to reassert their people's own culture, and that led to more and more violence. Now, India didn't go down such a darkly radical path as some parts of the Islamic world did. But let's have a little look more about what happened in the Islamic world, because it's really connected, obviously, to the reality that the vast bulk of the world's oil reserves are in these predominantly Islamic countries. I mean, if you take Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, I mean, that's got to represent two-thirds of the world's oil reserves. I mean, it's just an incredible concentration of oil in those countries. And they just happen to be Islamic countries. So you really have to understand the importance of this. You've got to understand how this is interconnected. And then you look at the successive waves of Western interference, primarily aimed at getting access and control, as the 20th century moved forwards, with oil being the most important resource. I mean, imagine, take your mind back to the beginning of the 20th century. This was the great age of industry, the great age of construction, of just building vast amounts of stuff and automobiles and transport of all kinds. And of course, the imperial powers, who were really interchangeably interconnected with the corporate powers, very, very large oil companies like BP and Exxon, they understood that their prime strategy, their prime goal in advancing their own power was to gain control of the resources in these parts of the world. And the way in which they went about doing that was a kind of an age-old, brutal path of stirring up violence, creating chaos, and then manipulating the players in that to advantage, like for an advantage to them. And they were able to do it because of their immense power and influence, and because of they had a history of doing it, going back many hundreds of years, they knew how to do this. And with each phase of this strategy that they acted out, you saw a more and more extreme, more and more dangerous, more and more evil reaction in the form of rebel groups, freedom groups, Islamist groups. And it got worse and worse, decade after decade, till finally you ended up with ISIS. We are going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's a great pleasure to be talking to you today. Stay with us. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And I'm just explaining today how the rise of the dangerous elements of Islamism has been a direct response to the acquisitive strategy of the West, the government-corporate partnership in terms of securing the vast oil wealth of those nations which happen to be Muslim, where all the oil is. Now, as I was saying, the Muslim Brotherhood was a direct response to the Anglo-Egyptian War and the British occupation of Egypt. the Iranian Revolutionary Army was a direct response to the British American control over Iran through the Shah, who was their man, for a period of about almost 30 years, from the early 1950s to 1979, which was a terribly corrupt and terribly brutal regime, and eroded the cultural elements of Iran, as well as exploiting Iran, you know, just to get access to the resources. And so we saw that the militant and, you know, legitimately scary appearance of the Iranian Revolutionary Army and the Ayatollah Khomeini was a response to that. It was an attempt to free the Iranian people from this stranglehold. And, of course, what it produced is something quite ugly. And if I might just make a parallel here, it's not that dissimilar to what we saw happening in Vietnam and Cambodia as the French were squeezed out but fought back, and there was a need for people to have something to, some form of ideology, some belief system to gather around to unite people against the colonial influence. And in Indochina, that ideology became communism. It wasn't initially communism. Initially, it was more a form of nationalism. But partly because China had already become a communist state, and China also had a lot of indirect influence on it, and also because there was some crossover there between Buddhist thinking and communist ideology, there was actually the creation of a kind of a philosophy, which the Chinese still follow, which does actually blend Buddhist ideas with communist ideas. What you saw in Indochina was this ideology of communism, which in many ways became quite violent and extreme, and we saw the worst outcome of that in Cambodia, which took it to another extreme altogether in a way which is actually has parallels with ISIS. And what happened in Indochina was a reaction to centuries of oppressive empire and control that did not allow people to did not allow the natural, the organic nature of the society of that region to evolve. And so when societies break free, they often do so in a violent and an ugly way, and this is what happened. So we saw the Iranian Revolution in Iran, and we saw things like the fatwa against Salman Rushdie and various signs that Iran was a country that did not respect Western values. And this was cause for alarm. I mean, a lot of people looked at that, you know, as the 80s passed into the 90s, Iran seemed to be a stagnant country with its regressive Sharia law. But I would put it to you that what we see in Iran is still the reaction of a country which sees itself under threat. And if you look at it ever since, well, forever really, Iran has either been completely under the grip of the West and controlled by the West, or surrounded by the West, Western powers, who attempt to find pretext to threaten and to limit its freedom as a nation. And I would suggest that when that stops, when that finally ends, Iran will be able to develop as a nation in the way all other parts of the world should be able to develop as a nation. And this applies to many other parts of the world as well, where repressive Sharia law has taken control. And I'm just looking at a map here that shows the application of Islamic law by country, and the strict application of Sharia law is clustered in the Middle Eastern states, apart from Sudan and Mauritania, which are in Africa. Sudan, of course, being closely connected to Egypt, and the Islamism of Sudan is directly connected to the Islamism of Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood. And the other states that we see, of course, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Yemen, Iran, Iraq, and Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now, okay, this part of the world, it is the focus of Western imperialism. Again, as I said, because of the concentration of oil resources in that region. And so when the imperialism ends, the extremism and the reaction to the imperialism will no longer have the impetus behind it. And of course, you know, you'll still have the extremists. They're still there. And of course, you know, they do exist in every religion. You have them in Christianity. You have them in Judaism. You have them in Hinduism. And you have them in Buddhism, people with extremist views. But that will drop down to a level that it doesn't completely dominate and control the society, and the civil society will be able to develop. But this will not be able to happen while the West continues its pattern of stirring up trouble, creating conflict, and more recently also stirring up fear and hatred among our own population of Islamic people. And I want to play to you a clip from a talk by Milo Yiannopoulos, who I respect as, you know, he has got a freedom of speech. I think he should be allowed to say what he wants to say. And I totally abhor the violence that was directed against Milo Yiannopoulos. But I've got to draw your attention to the fact that he is a provocateur. Some of the things he says are quite valid and I agree with, but some of the things he says are actually clearly provocative and actually quite wrong. And I will highlight for you exactly where he was wrong in one of his talks that I just was looking at on YouTube, where he spends about 10 minutes basically ripping into Islam and trying to, you know, run the case that Islam is an existential threat to the West. But he couples this with his other rhetoric, which I more agree with, against political correctness, against a lot of left-wing views. But he conflates the two. He conflates a libertarian viewpoint on certain things with a xenophobic, intolerant viewpoint and misconceptions on questions of Islam. And Milo is stirring up conflict. He's creating conflict. And there are certain other questions about what has been happening around Milo Yiannopoulos, which I think deserve to be further investigated, such as the black-clad, black bloc anarchists attacking his followers, which actually does have the hallmarks of a provocateur action as well. I don't really have time to go into that, but when we come back from the break, I want to play to you a clip of Milo Yiannopoulos, and I want to deconstruct some of the things that he actually says. We'll be right back. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I want to play to you now a clip of Milo Yiannopoulos talking about Islam. And this is from quite a long speech he gave at the University of New Mexico. And it was pushed up to YouTube just on the 27th of January, so it's fairly recent. Now, as I said, there's a lot about what Milo says that I agree with. But I find it very dangerous and very, very worrying that there's this conflation of the somewhat ignorant, prejudiced anti-Islam rhetoric with some of the views and arguments that are actually more balanced and more along libertarian lines. So I'm just going to play to you a clip starting from where he's talking about Islam so you can get the idea of what I'm talking about here. Here we go.
Now I'll tell you something else that isn't a race that America is going to have to deal with in the next decade, and that is Islam. Now, Muslims can be from the Middle East, from Africa, and they can even be soulless gingers from the United Kingdom. I wrote a piece about this, and nobody believed me at the time. Nobody thought I was telling the truth, and it was called Attack of the Ginger Jihadis. No, it's very true. There is, statistically, we did a survey of the literature, because the think tanks know about this, but they won't tell you, and the police will nod at you if you're a journalist and sort of say, well, yeah, we have noticed that, but we can't tell you anything about it. Basically, people with red hair are vastly more likely to convert to radical Islam. So the technical precise trend is white British converts to radical Islam are vastly disproportionately likely to be red-headed by an order of magnitude, like many, many multiples. And there are some, nobody really knows why it is. It could be that they get discriminated against, so they look for a club to be a part of. Or it could be that gingers are just genetically predisposed toward terrorism. Nobody knows. But it's true. But they can look like this. You know, there's a sort of hook-handed cleric in England who has a sort of harem of ginger groupies you sometimes see on the news. Anyway. Like any set of ideas, Islam is like a religion. It's any set of ideas. It deserves to be scrutinized. Well, I have scrutinized it, and I have found it wanting. I have found it lacking. Everywhere there is Islam, you will find women oppressed. Everywhere there is Islam, you will find... You're wearing a hijab in the United States of America. What is wrong with you?
Okay, I just wanted to point out that's the first directly provocative thing that he said there, talking about the gingerhead jihadis. It was just a little bit rude, but I wouldn't focus too much on that. But where he basically ridicules a woman for wearing a hijab in the United States of America, that's a very provocative thing to say, because let's face it, these people do wear the hijab. That's part of their religion. Okay. So he's basically saying, you know, you shouldn't be doing that in this country. Anyway, just continue. And I should point out, just watching the video here, the lady concerned, she's wearing a headscarf. She's not wearing a burqa. Her face is not covered. She's just got a scarf over her head. So for Milo Yiannopoulos to ridicule her simply for wearing a scarf around her head, it is really quite obnoxious, actually. And he's ruling himself out of the genre of civilized debate by saying that. And I'm not defending the people attacking him either, and you can't actually hear in the video what they're saying, but obviously they reacted to his statement that women in all Islamic countries are oppressed. Well, that's his statement, and there are protesters there in the back of the room who are shouting out in reaction to that.
You see, they want to shout you down by saying, oh, what about me? I'm not so oppressed. Well, let's move on from women. If you don't care about female genital mutilation, don't care about forced marriages, don't care about acid thrown in the faces of your Islamic sisters, if you don't care about any of those things, fine. Let's talk about gays instead. In 12 Islamic countries, I could be killed for my sexuality. Is that okay? People, 100 million people, live in countries where it is illegal to be homosexual. All of those countries are Islamic. This is not an ISIS thing. You know, you will see gays being thrown off the roof in ISIS-controlled territories. But this has nothing to do with terrorism. This is mainstream Muslim culture. Your religion does it everywhere your religion exists. It is.
Okay, just have to pause there. Of course, it's true that in many Muslim countries, homosexuality is illegal, but throwing people off rooftops is not done in many Muslim countries. It is done by ISIS. The main culprits, of course, being states that have the Sharia law, such as I mentioned earlier, Sudan, Iran, Saudi Arabia. But I should point out that homosexuality is also illegal in India, which is not a Muslim-majority country. And there are laws restricting freedom of expression for homosexuality in Russia. And another thing that's perhaps ironic is that many of the people who are actually supporters of the political milieu that Milo Yiannopoulos runs in are actually very much against homosexuality and don't believe it's legitimate. They believe it's a disorder. I mean, many people do who are otherwise supporters of the views that Milo Yiannopoulos is projecting. He's a problematic and paradoxical figure. But let me just continue now with the rest of what he has to say, because he makes a couple more gaffes here in his talk.
Is a threat, an existential threat to gay people. Everywhere in the world there is Islam, you will find women oppressed, homosexuals murdered, you will find gang rape. Now, there's a unique phenomenon that it doesn't really exist outside of Islamic cultures, of familial gang rape, where fathers, brothers and cousins go out raping people together. It happened in Rotherham in the UK. And the liberal establishment in the UK didn't investigate this because, according to a government report, not a far right-wing blog, according to a government report, 1,400 young girls were raped in racially or religiously, as you choose to define it, motivated crimes, because both the police and the authorities were too scared of being called racist to intervene. And this pattern repeats itself everywhere there is mass Muslim immigration.
I just point out, rape is a problem that occurs in every culture. India is one of the worst places for rape, and it happens not among the Islamic parts of India. What Milo Yiannopoulos is saying is he's a conflation of false association of ideas. He's pitching a viewpoint which is just false. I mean, of course, these things do occur within Islamic societies, but he's painting it as a problem specific to and intrinsic to and limited to Islamic societies, which is incorrect.
My suggestion to you, America, is that you don't need it here. Learn your lesson from 9/11. Learn your lesson from Orlando. These socially regressive... see, they walk out when they don't like the facts. These socially regressive attitudes... These socially regressive attitudes of Muslims in the West are horrifying. Absolutely horrifying. The surveys show that 52% of British Muslims think that my sex life should be made illegal. 39% of them. Why are you leaving? Why are you leaving? Don't you want to talk about numbers? Are you embarrassed? Are you embarrassed? Are you embarrassed of the hateful culture that surrounds your religion, that oppresses women and murders homosexuals and commits unspeakable acts of terrorism? Are you ashamed of it? Would you like to talk to us about why there's no global Muslim peace movement? Because I hear lots of very upset people at my talks complaining about statistics they can't refute. I don't hear a lot of Muslims standing up against terrorism. The problem is, to give an example, Hillary Clinton took $140 million from Saudi Arabia. You can't really expect anyone in the Democrat Party to speak up about this stuff.
We're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be back for one more segment. Stay with us.
In terms of creating wars, is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'll just play to you a little more of this clip from Milo Yiannopoulos, and then I've got another clip to play to you from Iran, which is an interview with Australia's Max Egan. So we'll get onto that in a minute. But we'll just finish off with this. Here we go.
And after Orlando, they didn't. And this guy was homegrown, and this is another very worrying thing. The Pakistani Muslims in the UK are becoming less integrated, not better integrated, as successive generations grow up. The UK now sends more fighters to ISIS than any other country, with the exception of Belgium, which has a huge Islamic radical problem. So there's something different. You know, you hear occasionally when people say, oh, well, you know, the United States is a nation of immigrants, and the UK is a nation of immigrants. Well, yes, that's true to a point, but the immigration we have now looks a little different to the immigration from the past. The Irish and the Italians who came in, many of whom, you know, particularly in New York, they came here because they want to participate in the American dream. But Islamic immigration to Germany and to the UK, and I'm sorry to say it's beginning here too, and I come as a warning from Europe desperately trying to persuade you not to allow this to happen, since you haven't learned your lesson from 9/11, and you haven't learned your lesson from Orlando, is don't allow these people to come here who do not wish to participate in the American dream, and to turn to make their lives better for themselves and for their families, but want to turn America into the shithole they came from. Don't do it. Yeah. 100% of Muslims in a survey done by Channel 4, a left-leaning broadcaster, said that they found homosexuality an unacceptable lifestyle choice. 100%.
Just should point out that a very, very high percentage of Christians in the United States would answer the same. Again, you see, he's manipulating you. Milo Yiannopoulos is a demagogue populist who is manipulating an audience that he is already receptive to the ideas. I just really want to emphasize that he is actually manipulating you.
More than Palestine, where it's 97%. Which liberals also love to stick up for. Never mind the fact that if you're gay, the only place you would dare to be in the Middle East is, of course, Tel Aviv. Now, if you want to see a real display of racism, you know, you might want to find one of your Hispanic friends who support Trump, who dares to speak out that they support Trump, and you'll see a real freak out.
Okay, I'll just leave it there, because there's some more stuff I want to play for you today. He does talk about genital mutilation in the speech as well. And genital mutilation is not a specifically Muslim practice. It is practiced in many parts of Africa that are not Muslim. It is done in some Muslim states. It is a tribal practice. It is not done in Saudi Arabia. It is not part of Sharia law. I should emphasize that. It's very important to understand that genital mutilation, which he refers to several times in his speech, is not a specifically Muslim practice. Now, I did mention earlier that there's an article by Tony Cartolucci. I just don't really have time to go into it in depth with you, but the article by Tony Cartolucci goes into the fact that the plan to turn on Iran had been crafted several years before, and of course it goes all the way back to September 11, 2001, when General Wesley Clark was told that there was a plan to take out seven countries in 5 years, and Iran being one of them. But in more recent policy documents by the Brookings Institute, a plan was laid out as to how an attack on Iran could be justified, by basically claiming that Iran had rejected a great deal that had been offered to them by the West, and that it was kind of out of disappointment that this attack was going to have to take place. I'll just quote to you here from the Brookings Institute report. Any military operation against Iran will likely be very unpopular around the world and require the proper international context. The best way to minimize international opprobrium and maximize support is to strike only when there is a widespread conviction that the Iranians were given but then rejected a superb offer, one so good that only a regime determined to acquire nuclear weapons and acquire them for the wrong reasons would turn it down. Under those circumstances, the United States or Israel could portray its operations as taken in sorrow, not anger, and at least some in the international community would conclude that the Iranians brought it on themselves by refusing a very good deal. So this looks a little bit like what is now being acted out with the plan by Defense Secretary Mattis under the direction of Donald Trump. We'll soon find out more about that. Let me now play to you a clip from Press TV, who actually interviewed Max Egan, well-known podcaster from Australia, on some of these developments over Iran. Here we go.
According to Trump, the White House has formally put Tehran on notice. Iranian officials have dismissed the U.S. threats as futile, stressing that the country will keep boosting its defensive capabilities. Tehran maintains that its missile launches fit into its conventional defense doctrine and have nothing to do with a nuclear deal signed between Iran and the six major world powers in 2015. Well, for more on this story, we go live to Brisbane, Australia, to talk to Max Egan, political commentator. Mr. Egan, thank you so much for being with us. What do you think of the aggressive policy adopted by the Trump administration in its first few days in office towards Iran?
Look, it's unfortunately quite predictable. I thought Trump would adopt this type of stance towards Iran. It's very unfortunate to see him doing it. It's interesting to say they're concerned about Iran's misbehaviour. I mean, what misbehaviour is this? I mean, Iran has been fighting terrorism in the Middle East as much as the United States has. The United States needs to realise that it is Islamic nations and Muslim nations that have been subject to far more terrorism than Western nations as a result of what's going on in the Middle East and where all the funding for all this terrorism is coming from, which is provably coming from Western sources. The amount of weapons caches that have been found from America and Israel and even England, it shows that where all the funding from this is coming from, plus the revelations of the Clinton emails and the activities of DynCorp also show where this funding for these terrorist forces is coming from. So if Trump is really serious about defusing the situation in the Middle East, he's not going to be doing it by posturing towards Iran. He needs to work with Iran and realize that both nations are trying to stop this overrun of Daesh terrorists across the Middle East. He needs to be a little bit more realistic about it. I think it's quite dangerous what he's doing.
But it seems that we cannot be really hopeful about seeing any change in the U.S. policy towards Iran in the sense that you just mentioned. For instance, following the latest ballistic missile test, we have heard Trump saying that he has put Tehran on notice. We have heard him, the U.S. announce new sanctions on Iran just because of the ballistic missile test. What can we expect in terms of sanctions, in terms of respecting the deal reached between Iran and the JC and the 5+1 group of countries, the JCPOA, under the Trump administration?
Look, I don't think Trump is going to honour that deal at all. I think he'd like to roll it back completely and impose new sanctions on Iran. And really, this is a nation testing its defensive capabilities. I mean, where is it said that a nation should not be able to defend itself? If the United States is asking nations not to put themselves in a position where they can defend themselves, well, what can we expect from this nation in the future? I mean, it seems to be withdrawing support from many of the nations that it's had support for so long. It seems to be Trump's put America first policy is basically meaning he's going to pull the rug out from a lot of nations that America has been allied with and in support. So it's a very, very dangerous move on his part. But I'm expecting him to posture more against Iran to basically divert attention from what the United States have done. They've got to paint Muslims as a threat. And there's been a big effort to do this, to make sure that the Western community sees the Muslim community as being a threat, to get them behind war with the Muslim community. And people have to wake up. I think the only thing that's really going to change it is public pressure. Is public outcry and a public stance against what Trump is attempting to do.
One thing I would like to point out along the lines of what I was saying earlier in this show is that the claim that Iran is the number one sponsor, a state sponsor of terrorism, this was made by Secretary of Defense Mattis. And this actually largely derives from the actions of Hezbollah, which are known to be funded by Iran. And it's very interesting. You look into the history of Hezbollah and you find out that Hezbollah was actually created in 1982, just after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And remember how I was saying that every successive wave of Islamic radicalism seems to be coming as a response to militaristic empire-building actions on the part of Western nations. And it's so consistent. And so what you saw with the rise of Hezbollah was that this was a reaction to the totally illegal, brutal occupation of Lebanon by Israel. And it was brutal. And there were terrible massacres that occurred. One of them was actually a massacre of Muslims by so-called Christians, the Falangists, which is renowned as being one of the worst massacres, one of the worst human rights violations of the 20th century. It sits alongside the rape of Nanjing as one of the most horrific actions that's ever occurred. About 3,000 men, women, children and babies were slaughtered in the refugee towns of Sabra and Shatila, most of them Muslim, at the hands of Christian militias. And this was all done under the watchful eye of the Israeli military commanders. That's the genesis of Hezbollah. That's how Hezbollah came to exist. Now, Hezbollah was implicated in a number of actions. You may question as to whether strictly Hezbollah's actions are terrorist, because most of them are actually against military objectives. There were a number of terrorist acts which occurred in Lebanon in the 1980s which have been attributed to Hezbollah, but cannot be proven to have been Hezbollah, and Hezbollah has denied their association. And then, of course, after that, after the invasion of Iraq, the destabilization of Syria, we saw the rise of Daesh, ISIS, which is just another step up in the spectrum of extremism and violence. So this is the one thing that I hope you take from this show, is that, yes, these things do exist in the Islamic world, but what's really causing them? And what's the best solution to stop it from continuing in the future? It's been a great pleasure talking to you today. I'll be back next week. See you then. Truth News Radio Australia, signing out. Established that the priority needs to be getting rid of ISIS. Now, here's where it's tricky for Israel. Because Israel, as I said before, and I think it's very clear to anyone who looks into this, Israel has engaged in promoting Islamic terrorism. And remember, from what we saw earlier in the show, Israel is one of the creators of modern terrorism. Israel established terrorism as a technique in the lead-up to the formation of the Jewish state. And they know how to do it, and they were much happier having Hamas, a terrorist organization, in charge of the Palestinian state than the PLO and Arafat, the Fatah government. Because, honestly, it's better for them, it's better in a PR sense, for them to be at war with extremists. Now, this is part of an empire strategy, part of the technique of the great game, as it goes back hundreds of years, that was practiced by the British Empire, is that it's much better to have a situation where you have crazy people that you're fighting against, and potentially having the crazy people fighting against each other as well, that also helps. But it's much, much better for an empire to have that type of situation than to have any kind of consolidated, coordinated, stable power that you have to confront. And Syria is one such power. Now, Syria, up until 2011, was a very stable country, and it was secular. It was diverse, And it just was on a different side of the equation in terms of power struggle. It was independent, but it tended to support Iran and Hezbollah. And, of course, there had been that conflict going back to 1967, where Israel actually seized some of Syria's territory, namely the Golan Heights. But Syria had remained detached for all of this period. It hadn't engaged in direct conflict, and it did actually support the US invasion of Iraq to topple the Saddam Hussein regime. But it was seen as an obstacle. So Israel, Mossad, the CIA collaborated to destabilize that region, and the best way to destabilize it is to bring extremism in, to create chaos and then provide that justification to go in and solve the problem. The old problem, reaction, solution scenario, which, of course, I've got the clip from David Icke talking about it at the beginning of this segment in the show. But it really does sum up the strategy. It's simple. It's been used so many times, but it seems to work for them. Now, of course, the other big issue that Trump has to grapple with as when he comes to power is the demonization of Russia in relation to his own election, to his own ascendancy. And this is ironic because the demonization of Russia is an agenda which is actually more connected to the American-Israel objective of dominating the Middle East than it is to any bogus claims about fiddling with the election and hacking and all this rubbish. The objection to Russia is that Russia is not facilitating the empire, the Western empire, in its attempt to control that region of the world. And I do see it's very hard to predict what's going to happen, because I see a paradox developing here where Trump has positioned himself as a more common sense, pragmatic person who wants to shore up these problems with Russia to work productively, because theoretically we all have the same basic goals. But then he's also said, you know, she said there in the interview, there should be no daylight between the US and Israel. And Israel is a terrorist state which is actually engaged in creating the problem that we now see in the Middle East. Anyway, look, have a happy new year, folks. I will be back in 2017, and it's been great talking to you. See you then.
Would you like to make more definite progress in your walk with God? Bibles for America is offering a free study Bible and a set of free Christian books you can read at home. The New Testament Recovery Version is one of the most comprehensive study Bibles available today. It's an accurate translation, and it contains thousands of footnotes that will help you to know God and to know the meaning of life. The free books are a three-volume set called Basic Elements of the Christian Life. Chapter by chapter, Basic Elements of the Christian Life clearly presents God's plan of salvation, growing in Christ, and how to build up the church. To order your free New Testament Recovery Version and Basic Elements of the Christian Life, call Bibles for America toll free at 888-551-0102. That's 888-551-0102. Or visit us online at bfa.org.